Welcome to Fronteras, a Changing America. I'm your host, Vanessa Dalbovich. The Obama administration claims it has dramatically changed immigration enforcement policy. Splashy worksite raids rounding up undocumented immigrants are just about gone. The main targets now are those with criminal records. But instead of praise, the government has been widely criticized, not just by opponents, but even by supporters. Fronteras correspondent Hernan Rosenberg explains.
To say Andrea Black feels deflated would be an understatement. Black is part of a growing crowd of immigrant advocates just about pulling their hair out over President Obama's track record on detention and deportation of immigrants. She and others had expected the president to fulfill promises of a much more immigrant-friendly approach.
Our members are very disappointed because any kind of reforms that they have made in the system are in the context of much increased enforcement across the board, lacking any due process or human rights protections.
Black is executive director of the Detention Watch Network, an umbrella organization representing several advocacy groups. She says the record number of deportations under Obama's watch contradicts his pledge of more compassion for immigrants. And she's highly skeptical of recent moves, such as reviewing pending deportation cases and the addition of a new public advocate within Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
Well, these steps they claim are towards greater transparency are too little and too late. So we really do not feel that this agency is up to the task, and it needs independent outside monitoring.
So far, ICE under Obama has been able to deflect such criticism. That's partly because advocates have not been able to grab public attention the way they did years ago by mobilizing massive marches. Francisco Duran researches the politics of immigration at the University of Texas at San Antonio.
The Latino community is not highly organized, and they hasn't been able to put significant pressure on the Obama administration.
But Duran says in what's shaping up to be a tough re-election bid, the president cannot risk further alienating the immigrant-friendly Latino vote.
So they feel that they have a room to sideline this issue, but now that the elections are coming, the game is changing and every vote counts.
If immigrant advocates feel dissatisfied, they can get in line. Those supporting immigration restrictions have been Obama's loudest opponents. They didn't like George Bush's efforts to overhaul the immigration system, but they say Obama has been far worse.
What the policy of this administration amounts to is backdoor amnesty.
That's Ira Melman, spokesman for the country's largest anti-illegal immigration organization, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, or FAIR. He points to examples such as halting thousands of deportations and allowing illegal immigrant spouses of U.S. soldiers to stay in the country.
They have not been able to get Congress to formally ratify legislative amnesty for millions of illegal aliens. And so the president simply decided, well, you know, if Congress didn't act, I am going to rewrite the law the way I see fit.
Alonso Pena retired last year as the deputy director of ICE. He has seen policies come and go, but he feels steps being taken now are working.
It doesn't make sense to be going after people that do not pose a threat to national security or to public safety when there's a tremendous number of people that do.
Pena says he's not about defending Bush or Obama. To him, it's about putting in place pragmatic enforcement policies. And those are not found in either extreme of the immigration debate, which, as things go, means no one will ever be happy with the system.
As long as we have this big divide between those that want to round up everyone and remove them and those that are wanting to give free pass and let them get in front of the line, as long as you have those two views and nothing in the middle somewhere, it's going to be difficult.
And not likely to change in the future, says Duran, the politics professor. He says American society is so bitterly divided over immigration that a major overhaul is out of the picture, no matter who's in the White House. In San Antonio, I'm Hernan Rosenberg.
For the sixth time in a year, Attorney General Eric Holder testified before Congress late last week, saying once again he did not know the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was allowing guns into Mexico. Newly released documents show the gun walking was widely known outside the ATF, and in fact, other government agencies interfered with ATF's plans. From the Fronteras desk, Michel Marisco reports.
Holder told the House Oversight Committee on Thursday that Department of Justice investigators are still trying to find out who in the agency made the decision to allow guns to cross into Mexico.
When I found out about them, I told the field and everybody in the United States Department of Justice that those tactics had to stop.
The plan was known as Operation Fast and Furious. Cartel gun buyers were being tracked by the ATF as they purchased the weapons in Phoenix and then smuggled them across the border. Guns were found in Juarez, Tijuana, even the border beach town of Rocky Point, federal records show. Congressional lawmakers critical of the Department of Justice released documents last Thursday that reveal the ATF had enough evidence as early as 2009 to arrest the gun buyers. The memo showed that the DEA in Phoenix had wiretaps on the straw buyers and shared them with the ATF. But no arrests were made at the time. The congressional report concludes that the ATF wanted to build their own case instead of sharing the arrests with the DEA. Ultimately, guns from those straw buys were found a year later at the murder scene of U.S. Border Patrol agent Brian Terry in December 2010. Tony Colson was the DEA official in charge of Tucson at the time. He says the problems ran even deeper than that.
In 2009, 2010, I became aware of ATF walking guns into Mexico. I also learned that Homeland Security Investigations, then ICE, actually interceded on more than one occasion where they seized weapons at the ports of entry when they were heading southbound, contrary to ATF's plans.
There was serious friction, Colson claims, between ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the ATF in Phoenix. When Colson took the gun walking to his bosses in Phoenix, he was told the lead law enforcement official in Arizona was already aware. That was U.S. Attorney Dennis Burke. Now, Burke has since resigned, a result of the public scandal that Fast and Furious became. Colson also claims that politics played a role in how Fast and Furious unfolded. The ATF officials who supervised the gun walking out of Phoenix were telling the news media as early as 2008 that 90% of the guns seized in Mexico came from the U.S. In other words, the same agency that was waging a public battle against gun smuggling was facilitating gun walking at the same time.
Around federal law enforcement, that became somewhat of a joke in that we all knew that that was whatever weapons the Mexican government decided to follow or trace back to the U.S. and never took into account the weapons that come in from Central America, from other countries around the world.
That number, 90%, was widely reported, but it was inflated. ATF officials quietly refuted those numbers later. They told auditors they were based on only a small portion of the guns seized in Mexico. In Tucson, I'm Michel Marisco.
A new documentary premiering in the border region focuses on the past year in the city of Juarez, Mexico. The film analyzes the city's violent image, as well as the upcoming 2012 election. In 2011, the murder rate in Juarez was down 33% from the previous year. While many might consider this a small victory, documentary filmmaker Charlie Min says it's not. Min joins us in the studio to talk about his new film, Murder Capital of the World. Talk to me about the motivation to make this film. You know, why Juarez and why now?
The situation in Juarez, I believe, is the most significant news story today that's not reported. It shocks me how people don't really know what's going on down there. Even in this area, the borderland, I still think is underreported even here. What we have is just a shocking wave of violence. In 2010, there were more murders in Ciudad Juarez than the 9/11 attacks. I would venture to say that 95% of the people in our country do not know that shocking statistic. Since January of 2008, we've had over 10,000 murders in Ciudad Juarez, which is 40% greater than both of our wars in the Middle East put together. I would say 95% of the people in our country don't know that either. We've all heard of 9/11. We've all heard of Iraq and Afghanistan. Where does Juarez fit into all this? Why aren't people talking about it? That's why the movie got made.
What was the process of making the film?
It was very difficult. I mean, obviously, the first concern is staying alive, and then just getting to the right people. Certainly, interviewing the police is dangerous because a lot of them are corrupt. I was able to procure a very important interview with the mayor of Juarez, and that's Hector Murguia, who used to be the old mayor. And he came back in fall of 2010. And a lot of people believe that he's working for the Juarez cartel. I think he's cleaned up his act for the most part. I know that there's a lot of people watching him now closer than ever before. And so I was able to get an interview with him that's sprinkled throughout the entire film, Murder Capital of the World. So in terms of making the film, I got a lot of help from the El Paso media and also the Juarez media, LD Audio as well. And without their help, this film couldn't have been made.
What times did you go into Juarez? Like, was it spans of days, just a few hours? What was the process for that?
Days and nights. Before I made Eight Murders a Day, which was my first Juarez film, I was going in there back and forth from El Paso for up to a year just to make sure that I knew what I was talking about, because this is a very deep topic. And for something as deep and as emotional as this, you don't want to just dive into it and make a rash decision on things and make a film out of it. Even after all this research, I can sit here and tell you that I'm not quite sure what's going on in Ciudad Juarez. I call it the ghost war, because over 95% of these murders are not even investigated. So because of that, it really begs three questions, and that is exactly who is being killed here, by who, and why. Those questions have to be addressed.
So where would you go? Did you have specific areas you wanted to target in Juarez, or did you try to cover, you know, the whole spectrum of the area?
We got shots everywhere, and you'll see that in the film. And we went into the colonias, we went to downtown, we went into the slums. 60% live in poverty. Like I told you earlier, we just had a big meeting with the mayor, and we went to press conferences, we went to funerals, and just everything. I mean, I try to show a range, and I did that, I think, in Eight Murders a Day and into this new film, Murder Capital of the World, which will open on Friday.
Who are some of the, you know, experts that helped you gather information for this film? What do you think they brought to the film?
A lot of experience and a lot of knowledge. And I will say this, even experts and adults are confused by this. So that's why I try to talk to a lot of college students and high school students. If adults are experts and authors are confused, what could a young student be thinking? So I like going into colleges and speaking and finding out what they think is going on. But I interviewed a couple of people here from Las Cruces, like Molly Malloy, who's a historian here, and she knows Juarez really well. Chuck Bowden, an author, he's written Murder City, which is about Juarez, and Down by the River. A couple of great professors from UTEP, Tony Payan and Howard Campbell, they know a lot about Juarez. And a couple of people from the El Paso Times, like Daniel Burunda, who covers the crime beat, and also Diana Washington Valdez, who she wrote a book called Harvest of Women, which talks about the femicides in Juarez. And that's what really brought the city into a negative spotlight, was back in 1993, when all of a sudden all these females started disappearing from the maquiladoras, which is the U.S.-owned assembly plants in Juarez.
So, you know, the film covers the last year, 2011. So through that year, what kind of trends or patterns did you see happening in the violence?
The murder rate is down right now. It's down by about 35%. It went from 3,111 in 2010 to 1,980 in 2011. So that's about a little less than six a day. So it went from eight a day to less than six. And now this year, after about a month and a half, it's down to about four murders a day. And that's no reason to celebrate. That's no victory. That's still too many people in one day. If you look at the 35% dip from 2010 to 2011, yeah, if you just look at that alone, it's good news. But to me, it really isn't. I mean, 2,000 more murders in Juarez in 2011, I mean, that's just inexcusable.
Now, you see, you mentioned earlier staying alive was one of your big goals. How were you able to get this footage and stay out of harm's way? What were some of the concerns, and were you ever in a very dangerous situation?
No, the only time, you know, I'd never actually seen someone get shot right in front of me, and I imagine that would be traumatic. So I've been lucky in that regard, but LD Audio really helped me out a lot. If it wasn't for LD Audio, I don't think I would have been able to make either film. They facilitated things for me. They helped me with the translations. They helped me get meetings. They just helped me set things up, get around the city, because they know the ins and outs of the city. So if it wasn't for their assistance, I wouldn't have been able to make either film. And I always try to credit them in every interview I do. So LD Audio de Juarez, LD Audio de El Paso, they were instrumental in helping me get to these places in Juarez. They know, like I said, all the ins and outs. So because of that organization alone, I was able to make this film and also, in the best way possible, stay in a safe environment.
So you say you never actually saw anyone get shot. Did you have cameras set up that were running, or did you just get past footage? How did that work out?
Oh, both. I mean, in Eight Murders a Day, we're cruising around night for a couple of hours waiting for something to happen. And that was kind of a funny situation, because you know it's going to happen at some point and you want to document it, but then you're happy that it doesn't, because then no one gets injured or killed. So we were kind of in a weird situation there. But, yeah, I mean, file footage from KVIA, KTSM in El Paso, LD Audio TV, Canal 44, and that's all combined with original footage as well.
What surprised you the most about making this documentary?
Just the body count. It just doesn't seem real. I mean, I don't know if people can really get a grasp on what's going on in Juarez. I mean, in 2010, there were 8 murders a day. I mean, that's a significant body count. So what you're telling me is if you have 2 one day, you have to counter it with 14 another. So just that intensity of 8 per day, and that's part of the reason why over 95% of these murders are not investigated. There's no police force in the world that could investigate 8 murders a day. There's just not enough hours in a day to do that.
Being that you've been documenting this for a while now, what do you see as the future? What do you see for the next year?
It's really hard to say because this is a ghost war. I'm not exactly sure what's going on. I mean, I've heard talks of Rick Perry even said it about if he was president, he would consider sending U.S. troops in. Mexico doesn't want us in there. But let's say we did send U.S. troops in. I'm not exactly sure who we're fighting here. I don't even know what would be the first place that the army would go into in Juarez, because you just don't know who's who. None of these murders are investigated, like I said, hardly any. So we're left with those 3 questions that I said earlier: who's being killed, by who, and why. So it's just a desperate, dire situation.
Now, asking why, or what do you think the role is that the U.S. plays in this war of the cartels in Mexico along the border?
Big-time role. I mean, we're supplying most of the illegal weapons to Mexico. 71% of the illegal weapons are going from the United States into Mexico for these illegal drugs. That's coming our way. We're the leading consumer of illegal drugs. That's a fact. We're sending millions and billions of dollars in cash to Mexico, most of that being wired through as well. So we're fueling this war. We're the root of the problem. The pot usage in our country is embarrassing, the way people get away with it. And in some way, if people are consuming an illegal drug, that could be in exchange of a dead Mexican baby laying on the street with a hole in its head.
What is your take on the way the president handled it? Would you have brought in the federal police as well?
Gosh, that's a difficult question. Felipe Calderon obviously saw something brewing when he took office. He won a very close vote over López Obrador from the PRD regime, from the party, PRD, the PRD party. And I think he wanted to prove to Mexico that his win was not a fluke. So 10 days into his campaign, he starts his military campaign against the cartels. I guess he saw something coming. Only him and his cabinet would know that. What exactly happened, why that decision was triggered. But as a result of that decision, we have over 50,000 dead Mexicans nationwide because of his decision of declaring war on the cartels. If you counter violence with violence, that's dangerous. That's a dangerous mix. He decided to do that, and as a result, we have over 50,000 dead across the country. And he saw something I guess Vicente Fox did not, because when Vicente Fox was president, Mexico, I believe Fox, while he was president of Mexico, they actually had the least number of murders of the last 5 or 6 presidents in Mexico. So Mr. Calderon apparently saw something coming, and little did he know that he was sending in a wave of criminals and murderers by sending in the U.S. Army and the federal police, because those organizations, they were joining the cartels.
Have you expanded maybe your research or your eye to other areas of Mexico? How is Juarez affecting other areas of Mexico, maybe in terms of economy, tourism, those kinds of things?
Well, the economy hasn't recovered yet. I mean, El Paso has gained a lot from this because so many people have fled Juarez and gone into El Paso. But yes, the spillover, not just into 300 U.S. cities, but also into the other 30 states of Mexico. Guerrero took a huge hit last year. Acapulco used to be a vacation resort, not anymore. Cancun's getting dangerous. Monterrey, the richest city, is getting very dangerous. We talk about Monterrey quite a bit in the movie. And Veracruz, even. I mean, the Navy was sent into Veracruz 2 weeks ago. And this is a beautiful state sitting right on the port. And now they're being affected by the violence. Cabo is being affected. Mazatlan. I mean, this is an unbelievable situation where I would say 24 out of the 31 states in Mexico is being affected greatly, and the other 7 just minor.
Now, how would you say that this film differs from the previous one on Mexico, the 8 Murders a Day?
8 Murders a Day was a recap of 2010 and Murder Capital of the World, which opens Friday at the Cinebor 10 in Las Cruces and the Bassett Place Mall in El Paso, is a review of 2011. And it also touches on the presidential election, which is critical. Coming up this July, we have a female running, Josefina Mota from the PAN party. She just won her seat a week ago. And it'd be amazing if Mexico had a female president. I'm actually personally rooting for her because I think what the country needs right now is some jolt, some shock to the system, and maybe a female president can do that.
In terms of our president, Barack Obama, how do you think he's handled this situation?
It's been a disaster. Mr. Obama should be embarrassed by his lack of attention and care towards Mexican people. He never seems to address it. He came to El Paso last year, and it was a wonderful opportunity for him to address the violence in Juarez. Never did. He's never been to Juarez. He's hiding in the White House. I call the man a coward in regards to the Mexico situation.
What would you say is the overall goal with projects like Murder Capital of the World?
Increase awareness and attention to something that is so unknown to so many people. And I'll go as far as saying for a lot of people in the borderland, I talk to a lot of classes at El Paso Community College and UTEP and a few at NMSU, and you'd be surprised how many people don't really know what's going on. Yeah, they hear Mexico's violent. Well, a lot of people have heard that, but can they get into the what, when, where, why, and how? And for some reason, it's not talked about. It's not reported that much. And it's a bit of a mystery to me. I think it's because maybe we feel so safe in El Paso. El Paso is one of the safest cities in the USA. Doña Ana County, Las Cruces, for the most part, is pretty safe. So I think it's almost like an attitude, okay, it's over there. It's not here. As long as it's over there, it doesn't affect me or concern me. I'm not going to really concentrate on it. And I think that mindset in the borderland has to shift. I think we need to see more care and support for the innocent Mexican people caught in the crossfire. My film Stick Up for Them. I'm giving a voice to the voiceless. And these people, they need to be heard. And they're not being heard. And the film sticks up for the innocent Mexican people who have been brutally cheated during this shocking wave of violence. And again, I can't get over the body count. It just doesn't seem right.
So how can someone find out some more information about your film and where can they see it?
The website's murdercapitalfilm.com, and it opens Friday, February the 17th at the Cineport 10 inside the Mesilla Valley Mall in Las Cruces. That's the Allen Theaters, and also at the Bassett Place Mall in El Paso. The movie's going to play for at least a week, and it's going to have around 5 showtimes a day.
Great. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us on Fronteras today.
You're welcome.
Charlie Min's film will premiere in Las Cruces and El Paso next weekend. For more information, visit murdercapitalfilm.com. Join us next week as we examine education and the Latino population in the area. I'm Vanessa Dalbovich. Thanks for tuning into Fronteras, a Changing America.